Having been both a Queensland police officer and a small business owner, and just out of his 20s, in November 2001, Minister Dutton was elected as a federal minister for Dixon in Queensland. In 2004, he was appointed as a Minister for Workforce Participation with responsibility for the Job Network, Disability Employment Services, Work for the Dole, and Transition to Work Opportunities for All Unemployed Australians. Following the change of government in November 2007, he was appointed as the Shadow Cabinet, firstly, and subsequently as Minister for Finance, Competition Policy and Deregulation, and in September 2008 as the Shadow Minister for Health and Ageing. He was subsequently appointed Minister for Health with the appointment of the Abbott government. So it gives me great pleasure tonight to welcome Peter to talk to us. Thank you.
Mick, thank you very much. Can I acknowledge Paul Dugdale and to Alison Verhoeven, to Bill Moss. It's great to see you here tonight, Bill. I'm looking forward very much to your presentation afterwards, to all of the distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Well, the theme of your conference, I think, sums up perfectly the dilemma facing developed nations around the world. In Australia, we have an ageing population with the public demanding early adoption of new medical technologies and listings of life-saving medicines increasingly targeted at smaller patient groups, meaning a dramatic increase in listing prices. This week in our country, about 170 people will be diagnosed with dementia. But by 2050, the number climbs to a staggering 7,500 per week. And with modern interventions and pharmaceuticals, people will be living with complex medical and care needs, potentially for decades. At the same time, of course, momentum is gathering for genomics testing to be listed on the MBS, as well as MRI screening for prostate cancer, and the list goes on. Governments need to fund the health challenges of today, including investing in prevention models and allow headroom for emerging costs. At the same time, Treasury reminds us that our country is borrowing $1 billion a month just to pay our interest bill, and that without policy change, that figure will climb to $3 billion a month within 10 years. So your theme has well and truly resonated. First-year budgets always court controversy, and in health, this budget was no different. Some of the headlines would have you believe that we were cutting our overall investment in the health portfolio, but spending rises from $65 billion this year to over $74 billion in 2017-18. It increases year on year. In this budget, we recognise spending on the MBS has grown 46% in the last 5 years, and today we're raising $10 billion through the Medicare levy, but spending $20 billion a year on Medicare, and without policy change, that figure grows to $34 billion over the course of the next decade. And so we propose to introduce a modest co-payment with safety nets to provide support to those who can't afford the $7. Those of you familiar with some European models or in New Zealand, where the co-payment is $17, will know this principle has been in place for some time. So anyone who stands up here and tells you that an approach other than managed and properly managed growth in our health expenditure will be misleading you. They would be talking against the expert evidence presented to both the Rudd and Gillard governments in the independent reviews conducted by Christine Bennett and Simon McKeon. We absolutely accept that a stronger and more coordinated response at a primary care level is essential to keep people, wherever possible, out of tertiary settings. But it's why we're determined to transform Medicare locals, some of which are doing great work, but many of which are not, into a primary health network which will derive better outcomes and also drive investment into preventive healthcare models. Relationships between doctors, nurses, and allied health professionals will be central to the model, but patient outcomes will drive remuneration and success for PHNs. We believe in transparency around their outcomes and creating a competitive tension across that network. And the government is absolutely determined to reform our health system otherwise, so that we can build a stronger, more responsive health system for a 21st century Australia. To do this, we will introduce new ways to finance and sustain healthcare in the years ahead, draw a line in the sand on ineffectual programs, on duplication, waste and unnecessary bureaucracy, and on unmanageable spending, and return to a public hospital funding approach which recognises states and territories as the owners and managers of public hospitals. Achieving sustainability means realising tangible gains in efficiency and productivity across the entire health system. Currently, our health system, whilst world-class and one of which we all should be immensely proud, has inefficiencies and waste exacerbated by the involvement of two and, in some cases, three levels of government. In this budget, we provide annual public hospital funding of $15 billion. 10 years ago, it was $7 billion, and without policy change, it was projected to grow to $36 billion in 10 years' time. Spending increases in public hospitals at 9% year on year are not sustainable anywhere in the developed world, and our country is no different. Therefore, the Australian Government has taken a number of decisions in this year's budget to ensure that public hospital funding is sustainable and affordable into the future. Our goal is to reduce the administrative and bureaucratic burden and to increase productivity. What we don't want is to provide open-ended funding guarantees for inefficient and unrestrained growth. Under the agreement we inherited, activity was funded whether it occurred or not, and that is as unacceptable for patients as it is for taxpayers. So our funding to hospitals increases by 9% this year and the next, but reduces to a more manageable 6.5% by the end of the forward estimates. The changes we've proposed are aimed at sharpening the incentive for public hospitals to control hospital costs and improve productivity so that they have the financial resources to address productivity and increasing demand, and recognise the reality that states and territories own and manage our public hospitals. In her 2009 report, Professor Christine Bennett, as head of the National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission, noted that, and I quote, "waste in healthcare is both an ethical and an economic issue." The National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission found that the hospital sector offers major potential for the achievement of efficiency gains. The McKeon Review's overarching message is that Australia needs a stronger connection between health and medical research and the delivery of healthcare services, with research and that evidence routinely translated into practice. While Australia performs groundbreaking health and medical research within its research institutions and universities, increasing pressure to deliver healthcare services has actually restricted research activity within health facilities. McKeon noted, and again I quote him, "the significant untapped potential to improve health outcomes and cost effectiveness of the health system." It's particularly relevant in the public hospital setting, and translating research into practice is low-hanging fruit in terms of achieving those efficiency and productivity gains. And we should all work with state and territory governments to make ground in this area, because it can help hospitals achieve better value for money and it can increase productivity. And not only can it help maintain safety and quality, it can enhance it. Research can identify and implement ways to avoid waste and promote evidence-based healthcare with the potential to improve health outcomes and reduce costs. Indeed, embedding research into healthcare will ensure that government investment in research benefits all Australians through better health outcomes and delivers the greatest economic value. Research drives innovation and gives rise to more effective and cheaper treatments, and the government understands this. That is why we've committed to the $20 billion Capital Preserved Medical Research Future Fund. The fund is the single largest investment in health and medical research ever made in our country, and will be of direct benefit to Australian hospitals and to Australian patients for decades to come. Not only will the fund transform how medical research is undertaken in our country, directly it will improve people's health through the discovery of new medicines and technologies used for prevention, treatment and cure. Indirectly, it will support improved productivity, jobs and economic growth. Medical research can help cut the cost of medical care by identifying the treatments that work better than others and identifying those treatments that have been superseded. The government's focus on research and innovation through the fund provides an ideal opportunity to embed research into healthcare. I think this is especially the case in the area of palliative care, and I want to touch quickly on this issue tonight. At least 50% of all deaths in our country each year are clinically expected because of advanced disease. Yet we do not currently have advanced care plans embedded as a routine part of clinical practice. Many of these patients are subject to futile and sometimes inappropriate interventions. Not only is this not in the clinical interest of patients, it's estimated that almost a quarter of health budgets are spent on inpatient care during the last 18 months of life without any real prospects of extending overall survival or impacting the quality of life. Advanced care planning has an important role in guiding end-of-life care and preparing and supporting patients and their families. Despite the evidence of its benefits, there is still relatively low uptake of advanced care plans in Australia, although they are slowly gaining prominence from both patients and clinicians. I believe the role of the Commonwealth is to encourage this trend by focusing on education, training, quality improvement and advanced care planning. I understand that they are difficult conversations to have, although I do believe it's in the best interests of patients that advanced care plans become part of mainstream patient-centred care. This means that the health workforce, from those working in primary care to those in hospitals and nursing homes, must continue their work in effectively educating patients about the benefits of advanced care plans. It is just one of many tough jobs in the healthcare sector, and I want to do more at a federal government level to provide support to those workers having these conversations and guiding people to make informed decisions. I wanted to close tonight on one of the most important discussions for our country in health, and that is in relation to a functioning electronic health record. Despite good intent and the Commonwealth Government having spent over $1 billion over the course of the last 10 years, we effectively only have several thousand people who have a functioning PC-EHR. In the 21st century, in a developed nation with a population of 23 million people, this is an outrage. We've been spending the past few months consulting with specialists, with doctors, nurses and patients, including from a variety of public hospitals, as part of our consideration of Richard Royal's review into the implementation and uptake of the electronic health record. The problems that plagued the former government's rushed implementation need to be fixed, and that's why we're listening to the views of stakeholders to ensure that we get the best possible system that delivers the best outcomes for healthcare professionals and patients alike. Emergency doctors have told me that the record must have a minimum composite of information regarding current medications, adverse events, discharge summaries to be of any value at all. This information is not only critical in saving lives, but will also significantly reduce the time it currently takes clinicians to perform information-led tasks, such as gathering patient information and transcribing results, time better spent for more critical activities. And as a country, we should embrace opt-out as the default when it comes to an electronic health record. Doctors in particular, but health professionals more generally, deserve in every setting, public or private, primary or tertiary, to be working with a health record which is meaningful to them and to their patient. It will help us manage the health and care needs of those 7,500 people diagnosed with dementia each week, and it will help us to manage cost pressures and reduce waste, allowing the headroom that we need for healthcare into the 21st century. We have increased funding in this budget and will continue to do so, but on a sustainable basis. Can I just say in my closing words, thank you very much, Alison, to you in particular for the way in which you've constructively engaged with me over the course of the last 12 months. It will always be the case that we don't agree on every issue, and press releases bear that out. And that's not at all. And I think that is part of a mature relationship. There are too many examples over recent years where relationships have broken down, and I don't think that's to the government's benefit, and I don't think it's to the sector's benefit either. And the fact that we've been able to open up communications in a way that hasn't been possible in recent times, I hope that we can expand on that work and that relationship. I think it'll be to the benefit of the association, the benefit of the government, and most importantly for all of us, to the benefit of Australian patients. Thank you very much.